Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Professor Simon Conway Morris is a fellow of the Royal Society. He's Professor of Evolutionary Paleobiology in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Cambridge. He's also the author of a number of books, including The Crucible of Creation, The Burgess Shale and the Rise of Animals, and Life's Solution, Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe. Simon Conway Morris is also a committed Christian. He's something of a communicator as well, and he joins us on Sunday night. Simon Conway Morris, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you very much.
Simon Conway Morris, there's much discussion about the politics of creation and evolution. Scientists use the arguments put up by conservative Christians on the absolute authority of the Bible as a battering ram with which to hammer Christianity as being an irrelevant superstition. Some conservative Christians come back and say, look, unless we accept the insights of the Bible, our moral universe is doomed. There's a wider context to this discussion these days too, in that so much of these debates, particularly whether or not we're prepared to accept the authority of science in certain areas, we risk the fate of the planet.
All true, all true. I mean, you say battering rams, and that's quite right, but I suppose my first impression is that these are battering rams which are mostly running across a wilderness, and also they're rushing past each other. And to be honest, there's remarkably little engagement. In other words, to my way of thinking, there is a distressing polarisation between, as you say, the creationists very broadly, and also another sort of fundamentalists, but these are ones which are sometimes referred to as radical atheists or the new atheists. And of course, as I think you indicate, we have the difficulties that for many people the Bible remains a central text of authority. On the other hand, science reveals very disturbing things, or at least things which are thought to be disturbing. And for many, many years, it seems to me that Christianity and science have got on just fine. But in more recent years, as you say, there is this, again, to speak perhaps a little strongly, deplorable division between what science tells us about the world, not least my own interest and fascination, that is, of course, evolutionary biology, and aspects of religious truth. And I think, in fact, a great deal of the problem at the moment is that people are not talking to each other.
Part of your task in life is to talk to people. You're one of those scientists who's chosen to inject yourself into the public discourse. Now, this is unusual for scientists. I mean, people like Richard Dawkins have made a career of it, but traditionally it's not an area in which scientists are strong. Scientists tend to specialise very narrowly and their communication tends to be technical. Is it something of a leap of faith, not only for you as a Christian, but for you as a professional scientist, to push yourself into the public arena in this way?
Well, it's certainly risky because, of course, in the end, you usually find that you don't actually satisfy anybody. I think the fact of the matter is that on a day-to-day basis, scientists need to do the rational pursuit of particular hypotheses, if you like. I think, though, if you push most scientists, and I think this is more true amongst, say, physicists and cosmologists and perhaps chemists than it is amongst biologists, one's always wanting to inquire, well, why is the world as it is? And so far as, say, cosmology is concerned, I think part of the enthusiasm, if you like, for the idea of multiverses, that is, that there's not just one universe, but perhaps an infinity of parallel universes, which, of course, conveniently always remain out of detection range. But the fact of the matter is we do know that our universe relies on an extraordinary degree of fine-tuning. And, of course, that could be just a glorious accident. But if you go to multiverses, you can say, yes, of course, we are the result of a very fine-tuned universe which allows the emergence of sentience. But on the other hand, look, there are all these other, well, not trillions, but literally an infinity of alternative universes, all of which are entirely uninhabitable because they didn't have the exact fine-tuning and we just struck lucky. The theological implications of a fine-tuned universe are pretty straightforward, though I would be very, very careful to simply say, here is a proof, let us say, of God's agency. I think things are a bit more subtle than that. Now, when it comes to biology, things are a bit different, of course, because the neo-Darwinian mantra, and I should say immediately that I have no problem with evolution. Evolution is a fact. But, of course, any science deals with further imponderables. And it does seem to me at the moment that evolutionary biology has gone into a sort of closure, if you like. I mean, whenever I hear my colleagues defending Darwinism, they keep on saying the same thing. But the point about science, of course, is we accept all that. What is it we don't know? Now, with respect to evolution, despite the fact that it is a fact, it seems to me there's a great deal of unfinished business, which ultimately might have some theological implications.
We'll talk about those in a few moments. Let's talk a little about yourself and where your interests come from and how it is that you choose to maintain a strong Christian worldview and are concerned to keep this Christian view alongside the very powerful science that you're dealing with. I mean, many scientists along the way would just eventually say, look, it's too hard a business. I'll just get on with the science. I won't become concerned with the Christian polemic. What is it constrains you to keep them together?
Well, in a certain sense, I suppose it's because I find science totally fascinating. And in fact, as it happens, in a certain way, I've had a very successful career. But it's also been sort of dogged by some really stupendous mistakes. And I think, you know, the fact that one realises that there's so much more work to be done, and I do quite a lot of work, for instance, in China on equivalence to a rather famous deposit in Canada. This is the Burgess Shale, which gives us wonderful insights into the first stages of animal evolution. But here, one knows that we're very much dealing with unfinished business. So how does one match that with Christianity? Well, of course, I'm sure there'll be a number of people who are either agnostic or even atheists. So what I next say, they'll have them, if not rolling their eyes, at least grabbing their email controls. I just happen to think Christianity is true. That is, of course, famously, it is developed from a Judaic tradition, but it does deal with various things which revolve around historical realities. Those historical realities, of course, most famously involve the resurrection. And again, there's a great sort of gasp of disbelief. You couldn't possibly believe that, could you? You know, we're in the 21st century. Grow up, grow up. But there's a very long tradition, both of theological insight and also scriptural analysis, which persuades me that the resurrection happened. And when you then start to open the field of fire, and now I see not only my destroyers on the horizon, but a couple of battleships moving into position. I see the turrets swinging towards the enemy. The fact of the matter is that in the case of science, it may well be that, in fact, what we know is an insignificant fraction of what one day we will know. There are all sorts of imponderables, and this is not to be mysterious. This is not to say that I'm a cryptic, intelligent design type, for example. It's that's nothing to do with it at all. It's simply the acknowledgement that even within evolution, I, for instance, think that I can find reasonably good evidence now that a good part of evolution is predictable. Correspondingly, the claims of Christianity are too often taken in an entirely literal sense. Now, literal, yes, that tomb was empty, but the implications of that are utterly staggering. And in their different ways, I actually find a great deal in parallel between the science which deals, in a sense, with the unknown, but the sense that we are on the edge of an abyss of ignorance, and correspondingly in the claims of a real God, not this sort of papier-mâché variety which is wheeled out by some of the atheists. There too, one senses that here one's dealing with levels of engagement which are genuinely infinite. So, you know, I feel very much as an intellectual that there are things where one can say, yes, I see a resonance, I see a resonance, I hear a resonance. And that encourages me.
You can't deal with two levels of reality. Like one of the problems that I guess kids in fundamentalist schools who teach essentially creationism have to deal with if they're dealing with science is in some ways two ways of viewing the world. One's their religious hat and the other is their science hat that they put on to go into classrooms and pass exams. It seems to me at one level you're setting up kids in this framework for immense problems, almost a sort of cognitive dissonance, because at some point or other, and it's a point you seem to have sort of moved beyond, you've got to put on one coherent intellectual hat that you apply to the whole of the world, including your religious world. You've mentioned the resurrection. But the problem for many here goes back to Genesis. How does one read Genesis? Is Genesis true, and in what sense is it true?
Oh, well, of course. And I know when I either debate or if I'm giving a lecture, I might well have an atheist standing up saying, you know, I see you're seemed to be a moderately intelligent chap, but apparently he also subscribed to this faith. I'm most puzzled. And correspondingly, at the other end, you'll have people who, as you say, will read the opening chapters of Genesis. And, of course, at one level, it is a gripping account of the creation of the world. But my problem, and of course, has been dealt with by very many theologians and priests and other people, is that it is, to begin with, simply a statement of poetry. It is simply a view of what the world is. And our problem, I think, is that partly in these days of instant communication and also sound bites and all these other things, the ability to sort of reflect on even a few sentences, which might take many years of reflection, is not necessarily one which is easy to convey, especially to children under pressures, both at home and with exams and all these other sorts of things. But the fact of the matter is, it seems to me that, without going on too long about this, that first of all, not only is the Genesis chapters a statement of poetry, but of course most emphatically, as the Jews understood, and of course Genesis, we believe, was written relatively late in the history of the biblical narratives in terms of what we call the Old Testament, is that this is a profoundly different statement from what any other civilization at that time was capable of arriving at. Very briefly, that God, well, there's a little bit of discussion whether he controls the chaos or whether, in fact, as we would now, I think, from the Christian perspective, regard it as creation out of nothing, creatio ex nihilo, as we would say. But either way, most famously, you know, when these stars and moons and all the rest of it are hanging around in the cosmos, we do not go around worshipping them. And this was something which was entirely alien to any other civilization. This was the person in control. There's another aspect which will only be of interest to Christians, I think, and that is my reading of it, and I don't claim any originality here, as I actually find some extraordinarily interesting parallels between the Genesis narrative, which is a myth. But by a myth, what I mean is not a fairy tale, but it's an attempt to convey levels of reality which are not easily accessible through any other route. But I do find some fascinating parallels between what the Genesis narratives have in the garden with the angels and with the expulsion versus, in a sense, what happened in reverse in the resurrection garden. And some of them are parallels which go together. Other ones, if you like, antitheses one to the other. Now, the point here again, and I think most scientists will find this incredible if they happen to be listening to it, and I'd imagine people who are involved with the rather literal interpretation, fundamentalists if you like, who I think sort of see things in a somewhat black and white way, again is to return to my theme that we are dealing with things which are unknown, we're dealing with mysteries, and these are not mysteries because I'm either stupid or somehow have a sort of vague sort of intuition about these things. These are things which are extraordinarily difficult to articulate. But the reason why I think it matters so much is, first of all, of course, humans almost universally have a religious instinct. I think that could even be said, in fairness, to atheists. But beyond that is, again, the sense that, do we understand about who we are? Obviously, there are things to do with the ethics, there are things to do with environmental conservation, but there are also profound questions because clearly the nervous system, amongst other things, the brain, are products of evolution. I can now show, using other people's work, I hasten to say, that I think the evolution of an intelligence is an inevitability. So that immediately opens the possibility that evolution has levels of predictability about it. Now, once again, the danger, the risk, but in some ways the attraction, say, ah, yes, then this is a possibility that somehow the whole thing is organised, somehow it's meant to happen. But that, too, I think, can lead to simplistic thinking, because it's not so much, you know, we must know this, I must be secure. I think the aspects about science and the aspects about theology and especially Christianity is at one level they are all a huge risk. And that, of course, is not something which goes down too well these days.
Yes, the idea of risk-taking in an era when we have too much risk associated with the world around us, too much instability, is something against which most people are sort of wanting to run away from. That is, look, it's already too unstable. I just want some security and certainty, please. The observation you make about Genesis seems to indicate that really the argument about Genesis is not one to be run in a scientific arena. It's one to be sorted out in a theological arena. That is, before one can have a debate about origins, one needs to establish what the nature of the texts are, what in fact the Genesis document is. So those people who are running this argument are sometimes running it in the wrong place, having an argument with science when they should be actually settling an issue about the nature of the scriptures and how they originated and that sort of thing.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, the thing, again, is that when one is dealing with, music would be one example, and perhaps some of the pieces I've chosen will clearly reflect my interests, but in each one of them, I think there's sort of, you know, a transcendence, which is almost impossible to articulate verbally, and correspondingly with the Genesis narratives. I mean, in a certain way, when one reads a great scientific paper and when one reads Genesis, they're utterly different in so many respects, but each of them is fantastically cleverly constructed.
And reveals certain things about us and about the world.
Yes, indeed.
Our guest on Sunday night, Professor Simon Conway Morris, a Fellow of the Royal Society, an evolutionary paleobiologist in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Cambridge, and also a committed Christian. Simon Conway Morris, let's now talk about the things that inspire you. You're an evolutionary paleobiologist. Biology, that area in which we're dealing with the science of life, the nature of life. Paleobiology, the ancient science of life, leads us straight into the territory of Charles Darwin. Yet you say, rather than Darwinism demonstrating that religion has nothing to say, you say that actually an understanding of paleobiology, an understanding of the way the universe has evolved, gives us a greater and grander sense of creation. Just explain how this is so.
A huge topic. Of course, Darwin himself, although I think his faith was steadily eroded through his long life, does conclude famously the origin of species with this view of the grandeur of life. And I think he never lost his appreciation and love and marvel, really, at this, the forms of organic complexity. And, of course, the many things we now know, especially about cellular chemistry and the genetics and so forth, I think he would be, in its own way, even more astonished. But, of course, famously, Darwin has also been taken as perhaps a key element to move towards a universe which is, in a sense, meaningless. In other words, evolution is a process whereby almost anything can happen. Well, it's a long and complicated story, but very briefly, I started life as a paleontologist, and I still do a little bit of work on fossils. I was lucky enough to be involved with the reanalysis of this extraordinary fossil deposit in British Columbia known as the Burgess Shale.
It's now, so just for our listeners' sake, the Burgess Shale is a Cambrian, a very old layer of rocks in which, very strangely, the animals do not seem, or the creatures do not seem to follow the body plan that, that most animals that we understand today have. That is, it's all sorts of strange mixtures of body plans. Yet out of this you seem to sense a coherence coming.
Well, I do indeed, and partly because once upon a time I thought there were lots of strange body plans in this Burgess Shale deposit, which has this exquisite soft part preservation, but I was wrong. New discoveries, mostly by my colleagues and rivals on occasion, have actually shown that what seemed to be this extraordinary medley and sort of cornucopia of unrelated forms and could have basically evolved in almost any direction. It now turns out, I believe, although this is still quite controversial, that these strange-looking fossils are actually key in explaining how you build body plans of any sort. And this is quite important for two reasons. First of all, because it shows that body plans, which, if you like, are a key element of the debate of so-called missing links, are assembled in an evolutionary way in an entirely unexceptional and, in a certain way, entirely unexciting fashion.
And that there is a certain inevitability one draws out of that.
Well, I would draw an inevitability about it because Stephen Jay Gould wrote a book which was very complimentary about the work we'd done in Cambridge. The book was called Wonderful Life. But his key argument was, and this is a famous metaphor which is much used by evolutionary biologists, were we, quote, to rerun the tape of life from the time of the Cambrian explosion about half a billion years ago, then the outcomes would be completely different. In other words, everything living today is, for all intents and purposes, an evolutionary fluke. You, me, tulips, tapeworms, name what you will. And that is a pervasive view in neo-Darwinian thinking. And it seems very sensible because we know about random mutations, we know about mass extinctions, and Gould's view that basically the evolutionary, well, I wouldn't say hearse, but it is mostly a fossil record, but the evolutionary carriages careering wildly from one potential destination to another very much, again, reflects current day sort of thinking. The zeitgeist of today is very much in sympathy with that. But I think there's a great deal of evidence against it, which at first sight seems very paradoxical, because after all, for goodness sake, as I say, we've got tulips and tapeworms as well as humans. What could be more different? It turns out that evolutionary convergence, that is the well-known biological observation that from rather different starting points in the tree of life, one ends up with very much the same solution, turns out to be far more pervasive, I think, than has been generally realised. Linked to that is something which is very interesting in as much as when we see what evolutionary biologists refer to as adaptive radiations, of which the Cambrian explosion, I suppose, is a mother of all adaptive radiations. It turns out that, in fact, it's not simply the case that one group evolves and that's that. And there's a particular example which perhaps might be worth touching on very briefly. We all know about the evolution of the birds in as much as birds come from feathered dinosaurs, and there's a wonderful fossil Archaeopteryx, which can be referred to, I think, usefully as a missing link. It combines both features of the dinosaur and features of the birds, and that's a key element to show that evolution does happen. Slightly less well known is that in the case of the evolution of these dinosaurs, two different groups also took to the air. They come from the same ancestor, but what it suggests then is that when you got to a certain stage of organisation, one's not too surprised that the next thing happens, but it basically happens inevitably. Give me a dinosaur, give me a theropod, and I will allow you to have a bird. And one can then begin to wonder whether, in fact, the way in which evolution navigates, for want of a better word, is rather more constrained than we'd thought. Now, again, this is extremely dangerous because I'm not saying, to begin with, that everything's meant to be evolving towards a human. What I would suggest is that on the basis of evolutionary convergence, on the basis of what we call adaptive radiations, also, this is slightly technical, but a great deal of what we associate with complexity, like a brain, well, that, of course, is in essence a chemical machine. A great deal of the molecular architecture you need to make a brain has actually evolved long before there were any sorts of brains. In other words, evolution, as we know, as good Darwinians, is brilliant at co-opting, bringing on board things which apparently have not a great deal to do with anything. So overall, what I'm really trying to establish is the possibility that evolution is actually a science, that is, it's predictable. But I'm also suggesting, of course, that there are levels of complexity here. So it's not simply trying to read in a literal working. And so the connections with theology, again, are not ones which simply match one-to-one, but it's the implications of what we see.
In some ways, you're doing what physics did some time ago, say with cosmology, and the look for the formula for everything. That is, there is once you establish the initial conditions, then certain other things inevitably follow within a broad framework, and that same principle applies to biology.
That is indeed my suggestion, and other biologists have certainly drawn attention to shortcomings in the Darwinian explanation being able to explain everything in biology, and they are people like Stu Kaufman or Brian Godwin, and these are people who are very interested in properties of self-organization, the way things seem to sort of pop out of not nothing but out of something which we might regard as a somewhat unexciting substrate of possibilities. But one has to be so careful here. But I think the thing about Darwin, which I find a little bit puzzling, is the degree of veneration which he enjoys. And as you mentioned, we are in the Darwin year, his bicentenary, and 150 years since the publication of The Origin. I can't think of any other scientist, and arguably people as great as Newton or Einstein are enormously respected because of their dazzling intellects, but they don't have at the same time this sort of, I think, slightly creepy sense of veneration. And that tells me something quite interesting because, as I think I mentioned, you know, in some ways evolutionary biology seems to have gone into a sense of closure, whereas, of course, Newton got it right up to a point. Then we have Einstein, but Einstein, of course, failed ultimately and spent the best part of his life struggling with something which he never succeeded in understanding, and we still don't to the present day.
The theory of everything.
The theory of everything, yes, indeed. And you know, there are sort of there's a sort of sense now that we really are beginning to move towards a new sort of physics. But of course, it depends on particular bits of machinery, and even those will not be powerful enough necessary to take us very much further. But I would, with great respect, say, of course, Darwin got it right. I mean, his mechanism is unexceptional and is a brilliant insight in a comparable way to Newton's understanding of what gravity was. But Darwin was right up to a point. And of course, you know, I sense that evolution has a great deal more to say about who we are. But fascinatingly, when I talked about the evolution of the brain, for instance, and again, many of my secular colleagues would not agree with this at all, but I think we have simply no understanding at all about what consciousness is. It's clearly the product of evolution, because brains are a product of evolution, but what mind is and how that fits into this agenda is something where one just is almost lost for words.
You're on Sunday Night. Our guest, Professor Simon Conway Morris, Fellow of the Royal Society and Professor of Evolutionary Biology, or Paleobiology, at the University of Cambridge. Simon Conway Morris, we just alluded there, the sense in which evolutionary theory, and I use that term again cautiously because the word theory gets abused here, but the principles of evolution are now utterly pervasive. That is, it's not just simply the area of paleobiology. It's in everything from physics to medicine. Nothing.
Of course, as an exploration of who we are, I find it totally fascinating because I look at myself in the mirror, not always necessarily a desirable thing to do, but you know, in a sense, there's the ape just beneath the skin. And of course, I know that deep within me, there are things which were once bacteria, and correspondingly, wherever I turn, be it my bones or the cells in my bloodstream, or the arteries or the heart, whatever you care to mention, each one of those has an evolutionary lineage, and unravelling those lineages and how they come to end up as ourselves is in its own way deeply absorbing. But I think the point about this is evolution in the final analysis is simply a mechanism. Darwin got it right. All attempts to find alternative sorts of evolutionary mechanism, the one most familiar is that referred to as Lamarckism, basically fail. And in that way, we have an algorithm for change. But that algorithm tells us nothing about why things change in one way or the other. Now, if indeed it was the case, which I now believe to be utterly incorrect, that evolution could go in any direction you care to mention, then that would be the end of the matter. But in a certain sort of way, the Darwinian theorem lacks, if you like, traction. And I think, again, in most sciences, what one finds is that there are levels of explanation. I think this is most obvious in physics, whereby you have a sort of common day explanation, which would revolve broadly around Newtonian mechanics. But of course, when you wish to look a little bit more deeply, then one sees quantum mechanics. But the strong instinct is that there are other levels of understanding which are awaiting to be discovered. And I think the same thing is true of evolutionary biology, not only because we have existing hierarchies, be they molecules to brains and that sort of business, but if I'm right about my ideas of evolutionary convergence, then again, speaking in a metaphor, I have the sense that there is, if you like, a landscape across which the evolutionary process must necessarily navigate, which to begin with begs the question as to what is that landscape? Well, when you deal with complex science, such as quantum mechanics, one mostly deals, in a sense, at least for present-day understanding, in a sort of metaphor. And I wonder here whether there are deeper realities which underpin the evolutionary process. But there's something, of course, which is equally fascinating, and that is, of course, that biology deals with things which are alive, and we don't really understand what life is to begin with. But again, if one subscribes to the possibility that there is some sort of evolutionary landscape and the routes through that landscape are highly constrained, that's why we see evolutionary convergence in essence, this can be looked at, if you like, as a way in which the universe itself can become self-aware. That's, of course, that we are conscious. And if we became self-aware, then one could extend it to a theological argument. It's not a scientific argument at all, that this is God's agency to allow the universe to discover not only itself through our agency, but also to discover its maker. And I don't think it's anything, in a certain sense, it seems to me sort of rather obvious that might be what's actually the case. But there too, one is dealing with the fact that because something happens, it does not explain why it happens.
The consequences of that for Christians
are significant, Christians in particular. This is by way of we'll have to make this our last question. If Christianity does not come to terms with a coherent way of understanding this evolving universe, it poses serious dangers not only to itself, in that it becomes irrelevant, disconnected from perhaps an understanding that is deeply religious, but it also risks serious damage to the planet, in that at the moment the debate over the future of the planet, particularly the nature of climate change and other things, depend on the insights of, in many ways, sciences that are based on an evolutionary understanding. So this is a critical practical importance as well as theological or metaphysical importance.
Well, it is certainly of the greatest importance, and in a sense, whatever you say is bound to offend or alienate somebody. One could, and I certainly would not say, well, look, what's the problem? You know, Darwinian evolution is a competitive process. We see, for example, amongst the social insects, that they appropriate as much as they possibly can of their resources. And if you have the emergence of a species which, in a sense, understands how to do all that, then do not be surprised that the planet goes towards this particular endpoint, where effectively it's turned into one massive farm. And then, of course, you immediately say, well, this is absolute rubbish, because, of course, we have an ethics of conservation, and we might even have a little bit of self-interest, in as much as global warming would be an environmental catastrophe on an already very crowded world. Well, I think to begin with, actually many of the churches are becoming far more involved and aware of this. And I think it's also the case that there's too often a misreading of the Genesis narrative, which claims that because we sort of, if you like, are superior to the animals, and in one sense that's manifestly correct, that somehow then we're just allowed to take everything under our own wing. First of all, we are stewards. Second of all, of course, we are dealing with a real creation, and I think from a theological perspective, we can look at that creation both as something which is totally marvellous, but also something which is a gift. There's also very much in the Christian tradition that we will be called to account. And now, again, that then is often transfused or transformed into the secular thing. Oh, here's this person with brimstone and hell and all these other things behind it. Well, we could talk about hell if you so wish, but I think hell is simply not knowing who God is. But from the environmental perspective, the Christian tradition insists not only was the creation out of nothing by God's good grace, but also, despite sometimes appearances, it is fundamentally very good indeed. But also, in fact, and again, this will seem like obscurantist rubbish, the Christian tradition insists that we have an eschatology and that the world will be transformed. And by that, I mean our world, not some airy-fairy sort of heaven. And it could well be, then, that as has happened in other religious episodes, those who were given the choice and turned their back on the choice then were, if you like, neglected. Now, these are all very dangerous and controversial things, and of course they have political resonances of one sort and the other. But I think in a way the environmental movement will only recapture the high ground if it actually takes a religious perspective. And so, for instance, E.O. Wilson, who is one of the greatest living biologists and a person who I have not personally met, but I have enormous respect, has suggested that we somehow must transform our religious instincts, which are universal amongst humans, into effectively a scientific program to rescue through environmental action and the conservation of species and all these sorts of things into a new paradigm which will enable us to save the planet. Now, as a principle, I have no quarrel with it at all, but I'm with great respect, and in fact I reviewed one of Wilson's books in Nature a couple of years ago, I don't think it has the least chance in working, because ultimately we are spiritual creatures, and unless we combine our spirituality with the environmental ethic, then I think, in fact, the thing will, as we find so often in history, with the very best of intentions, by the very best of people, things go sour.
Not an optimistic note on which to end.
Well, I'm optimist, don't you worry. But
I take it you actually think that religion has immense power both to inform the debate and to transform those who accept the principles of a religious worldview to actually transform the world.
Oh, I think, well, it has transformed the world. I mean, I have as a sort of counterfactual, based on a particular essay by somebody else, what would have happened if Pontius Pilate had dismissed Jesus and said, no, go off you go, you're free. A world without Christianity? I mean, again, the secular individuals, perhaps Richard Dawkins, I think, you know, just imagine what that world would be like. I think it would be, Christianity has many sins at its doors, undoubtedly, but I think a world without Christianity would be infinitely more horrible than the world which we enjoy.
Simon Conway Morris, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks for giving us your time.
My greatest pleasure. Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.